It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest lays out the challenges facing healthcare in rural Wisconsin.
First, last night, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett eased curfew restrictions for teens. The restrictions were put in place after a police shooting earlier this month sparked violence and unrest in the city.
The end of the curfew came at the same time as the Milwaukee Common Council delayed the release of a public safety plan, which is the result of an effort this summer by the council's public safety committee. The committee invited local law enforcement, corrections officials, prosecutors, judges, and youth advocates to a series of special meetings about crime after seeing increases last year. The plan was supposed to be released yesterday, but was instead released this afternoon.
Mary Spacuzza obtained a copy of the plan and reported on it. She joins us now. She is a reporter who covers politics and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a thumbnail sketch. We'll get into more of the details, but what's in this new plan?
It has a pretty broad range of recommendations that include those for the city of Milwaukee, for Milwaukee County, and even for the state. But it includes calling for boot camp style and rite of passage programs for at-risk youth, increasing the number of sheriff's officers or sheriff's deputies to patrol parks, more police officers, cutting down on electronic monitoring and having people stay in detention for longer periods of time. So it's really a pretty, it's got a lot of kind of what you would consider very traditional law and order, crackdown on crime type of recommendations, which obviously, you know, we've heard a lot about incarceration in Wisconsin and particularly in Milwaukee. So clearly that did raise some eyebrows among some of critics for those kinds of proposals.
Now, there were some interesting developments with the release of the plan itself. Originally, it was delayed. Its planned release wasn't happening on schedule, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel did get an advance copy. How did that all work out?
How did we get a copy?
How did you get a copy before, I guess, it was released, it sounds like?
I don't think we'll exactly get into that right now, but I can say that I think that, you know, it was distributed to some folks who were presumably had some concerns about some of the recommendations, especially with the increasing detention, the boot camps, sharply increasing the number of police officers and sheriff's deputies. And certainly there are people who on the council, including the chair of the Public Safety Committee, who backs those proposals, but there are others who don't and think that that's actually going to, you know, worsen things instead of improving them. But we did get, you know, and it actually looks like the final plan, which now they're saying is really more of a conversation starter, and after these this summer of meetings, they now want to have essentially kind of public input. So they want to take this plan, and I think the president of the council, Ashanti Hamilton, called it a working document and really just kind of a conversation starter. So rather than a final plan, this is more of a, I guess, starting point now. And he did say that part of the reason for it being delayed was the incident in Sherman Park and how a lot of council members were obviously dealing with pressing issues and didn't get a chance to read the report and give feedback. So he did acknowledge that the incidents in Sherman Park contributed to the delay.
And there seems to be an emphasis on increased detention and maybe incarceration in the plan as it stands right now. More specifically, again, what does the plan call for?
So it says that it wants to reduce over-reliance on electronic monitoring of adults and youths, and it talks about how electronic monitoring has limitations, and essentially that if people can still commit crimes when they're on electronic monitoring, and essentially, I'm reading from the draft, so I would need to, I'm not sure if this wording is in the final report that was released today, but it said that those who have been arrested for serious crimes, including juveniles, should remain in detention until they are adjudicated, and basically those who have been convicted of crime should remain incarcerated until their sentences have been served. So essentially, they would increase the number of those who are incarcerated and limit electronic monitoring.
And as you were getting at a little before, Milwaukee does stand out as an epicenter for black male incarceration. Is this plan being seen at all at odds with a call to reform Milwaukee's criminal justice system?
Certainly, that's a concern that has been raised by critics who saw this and said, like, whoa, this is not what we, this is not the direction that we want to see things head in. We want to see fewer African-American males incarcerated, not more.
We're talking with Mary Spacuzza right now, reporter who covers politics and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're talking about the Milwaukee Common Council Public Safety Plan, which was released this afternoon. And Mary, what kind of response has the plan gotten, I guess, in specific from the county executive's office?
You know, the chief of staff sent a statement yesterday, and I'm hoping to follow up with them again today, but essentially raising some of those concerns. They said that they appreciated the, you know, dedication of the Common Council, but that they essentially cited concerns about police and community relations, incarceration, racial disparity rates, that essentially calling for solutions that go beyond more police and more incarceration, and the idea that they'd like to see alternatives to detention and as a way to improve public safety, but also get people out of jails and into work or community programs.
Now, the plan, at least the draft of the plan that you've reported on, didn't address the root causes of poverty and crime. And I know that's something the county executive's office has an interest in responding to directly. So is there a sense about how that conversation will go forward at this point? Just this plan doesn't seem to get at that so much.
Yeah, so President Hamilton mentioned at today's news conference that this is really a multi-pronged approach, and that this public safety action plan is only part of it, and that they're also working with pastors and religious organizations and community groups and want to work with MPS and others. So basically, I think he was trying to acknowledge that there are other routes to take to get at some of these root issues, and that this is really just one piece of it instead of the whole puzzle.
Let's look at another aspect of the plan. Young offenders. What does the plan say about how it hopes to address young offenders in Milwaukee County?
It talks about the boot camp style or rite of passage programs for at-risk youth. So it would basically be kind of a local boarding schools for reforming youth offenders. It also talks about alternatives to Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, which I think a number of Milwaukee officials have already called for, of, you know, moving the youth who are detained up north to facilities closer and more, taking more of a regional approach so they wouldn't be, you know, 3 hours away, 4 hours away. And it also talks about kind of evaluating the juvenile justice system, that obviously is pretty broad of what that means.
And as you said, this plan and its approach to young offenders, it comes on the heels of this scandal at the Lincoln Hills juvenile facility. Is this the response? Do you think that will be, I guess, sort of leading the charge going forward, or will there be other aspects looked at?
Mayor Barrett had previously called for reopening Ethan Allen nearby. Others do not support that approach and want more kind of smaller facilities rather than the larger, what critics call warehousing. They've talked about regional approaches and keeping young offenders closer to their families. I think most in Milwaukee want to see an alternative to Lincoln Hills and an alternative to Copper Lake. I don't know that they have necessarily agreed on what that alternative would be, and obviously the big question is how to pay for it, because they've got to get the state to buy in to spend money on something like that.
You said earlier that at this point the plan has been released and it's being billed now more as a conversation starter than a plan that will go forward without a lot more input. So what might those immediate next steps be?
So they talked about having public meetings to get input from the community on the north side and south side, and really getting feedback from people about what they think about this. You know, obviously the budget is going to be coming up pretty soon, and anything that would be incorporated in this upcoming budget, and I don't think they have a ton of time to start having those meetings. And obviously this comes after a summer of these special public safety meetings. So, You know, I guess the question is, how many more meetings will there be if there's just two and they happen quickly enough that they could incorporate some of the suggestions into the budget? That would probably be more useful than if they, don't happen right away and they come too late for this budget.
Mary, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Mary Spacuzza. She's a politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, joining us there to talk about the Milwaukee Common Council Public Safety Plan, which was released this afternoon.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to a guest who says people who label themselves as introverts are limiting their opportunities in life. We'll find out why.
Right now, healthcare has been a huge issue in American politics and the economy, going back decades even before the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Issues like rising healthcare costs and who pays for them are still playing out in the current election cycle.
Our next guest says one part of healthcare can get lost in the shuffle, and it's of special importance here in Wisconsin. In a recent piece on the County Line website, he says we need to pay attention to the unique challenges facing rural healthcare and an urban-rural divide in the industry.
Tim Size joins us now. He's executive director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for asking.
Well, what are some of the unique challenges facing rural health care providers here in Wisconsin that the rest of the state might not know about?
Well, I think the first thing is to say, I think compared to many other states, rural Wisconsin health care is very strong. But like you mentioned, the whole country, we're all dealing with a lot of challenges. A set of challenges that I think is unique to rural would be the whole issue of competition, which probably other people have listened to your shows and read the newspaper know it's a big part of healthcare these days. I think what is different is, and I'm actually speaking to you from Madison today, in Madison, competition exists and it's strong, but regardless of who's winning or who will win at some point in time in the future, local access is assured and local jobs are assured. In other words, the one clinic or one health plan getting more business or less business, you still in the community are going to have local access. You're still going to have the same number of jobs. Whereas in rural Wisconsin, we have to, as we compete, we have to be as successful or better in terms of personalized care, in terms of quality, in terms of cost. But unlike our urban colleagues, we have to also worry about how do we keep the choice, the option open for people to get health care local? How do we maintain jobs local? So to me, it's a very clear difference between the challenges that rural Wisconsin has versus urban.
Do you see sometimes a cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all approach from policy experts on health care who may have solutions that work well in an urban area, say, and not so well in a rural area?
Yes, I think that's very often the case. And I've worked at the co-op now like 37 years, and I was at the university a little earlier doing some rural work. And I very rarely have ever found anyone that was like anti-rural, against rural. But often people don't understand rural because they're living, working, maybe raised in an urban, suburban community and just haven't had the opportunity to understand what's different.
Well, one thing I wonder, looking at rural healthcare kind of from the outside, is there a problem? Is it difficult to get the full range of specialists or the high-tech, high-cost equipment that might be accessible in an urban area?
I think there's clearly a challenge that every rural community, a hospital, clinic, local system needs to think through. Or what are those things that they can provide well, and what are those things that they have to have a good relationship and ability to refer into an urban center. Most of healthcare actually is about primary care and services that are well within the scope of the smaller clinics and smaller hospitals. So that's an issue that I think is often brought up, but it's probably not as big an impediment as people think. Plus, it's amazing the equipment and that is out there in rural areas. We're lucky in Wisconsin. I think we have hospitals and clinics in rural areas that are doing a lot of top-notch technical work. They have their own local specialists. They also have specialists from the cities that come out. So I think when you look at the data, most healthcare in a rural community can be provided locally.
And that's a priority for you, your organization, and for you personally. It sounds like that people have access to as local a care as possible. What are some of the reasons for that?
Let me just say, back off a second, and then I'll answer. There's a quote that very much relates to your line of questioning from a friend down the Monroe Clinic, and it's saying that bigger isn't better, better is better. And so there is this sense in our society, and from any number of different ways, I guess, that bigger just is necessarily better. And I think rural healthcare is very much about providing care locally. That's what we know over and over. If price and quality expectations are met, that's where people want to get their care. Some of the barriers we have is relating to the competitive marketplace and healthcare plans. I mean, so I know people can go and buy a health insurance policy that, or get one from their employer that they're very satisfied with in terms of, or relatively satisfied in terms of the premium and deductibles. And unfortunately, sometimes then they read the fine print and they find out that they actually can't access their local hospital or access local physicians. So that's something we're increasingly spending energy on. There's a regulatory oversight in our state, as in some others, that talks about the issue of provider network adequacy. It's also part of Obamacare and some of the expectations they have. And that's still something being worked out as we move forward through this health reform era. Currently now, and I hope it continues that way, our state law and regulation expects health plans to be respectful of the way people have historically been able to access care locally and not undermine that. But that's still something that's being played out in the marketplace. Another reason why it's important is simply the economic impact. I don't know if I mentioned, but like there's 40 hospital and local health care systems in the co-op, the statewide. These are smaller hospitals, but in aggregate, they employ 23,000 people. They are responsible for about $3 billion worth of direct and indirect economic impact across our state. So we have rural healthcare is a big part of what's helping maintain a balance, to the degree we have balance, between the rural and urban economies. So the issue for people in the local communities and policymakers who care about this, it isn't just about healthcare. It is about the local economy. And so if you're concerned about the local economy, it's not just about the wise purchase of healthcare in terms of quality, in terms of local access, but it's also, is it supporting the local economy? And we know that for every two jobs we create in healthcare or lose in healthcare, we create another one job in the rest of the local community. So the economic impact on the community is really just huge.
We're talking to Tim Size, Executive Director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative, about some of the challenges and opportunities facing rural health care providers here in Wisconsin. Tim, talk a little bit about the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative. What did these health care providers get together to do? What are some of the things you've succeeded at?
Well, I guess I could talk all day about the co-op. I've been there 37 years. I got started there after having worked at the university in that capacity, helped develop the co-op with a number of rural CEOs. It's just kind of like what it sounds. Actually, our original bylaws were for a dairy cooperative, and just crossed off the word dairy and put in the word rural hospital, and that served us very well for quite a few years. So it's owned and operated by now 40 rural hospitals. We have a twin mission of advocacy and shared services. 90% of our budget is for shared services, and it runs the spectrum from things related to quality improvement to, as I kind of implied, working with health insurers to electronic health records, kind of across the board of issues that the rural hospitals and clinics need to work on. We also, and I'm very proud of this, we probably host about, well over 300 meetings a year where basically people doing similar work in rural hospitals are able to get together and network with each other and compare best practices, and they can do that either by coming to Sauk City, where our office training center is, or by coming in virtually by web access. And it's probably the one thing we do. It's the thing that I think the hospitals most appreciate because it really helps to reduce their isolation. And even if they're members of one of the larger systems in the state, what we provide is that rural-to-rural conversation.
In that piece you wrote that we mentioned in the County Line website, you say there's an urban-rural divide, and people are familiar with that maybe politically and culturally in Wisconsin. We have that in terms of our health care, too?
I don't think so. Other than, let me back off. We have it in some situations, and I think I mentioned the issue of how competition plays out differently in rural and urban. And obviously, a lot of the big insurance companies and system have are more urban centered. But I think in general, there's a strong collaborative strain across Wisconsin, and so we work well with our two medical schools. We work well with the other statewide associations. We look for partnership opportunities with the multiple systems. Having said that, we're very aware, and we, as I mentioned in that article, that there are basic times where people in urban areas just simply don't appreciate some of the values that rural bring. I think a good example is these are all generalities we're talking about, but compared to the average person, I think, say, in Madison, people in rural communities have a deep affinity to their place. Like someone who works with me back at the co-op, she's basically, her family has lived on the same farm for five generations. So they a deep sense of belonging to that local community and support for that local community, which is actually, I think, an inherent strength of rural health care, because we do have that really strong loyalty.
Magic wand, Tim, briefly as we wrap up, what would be one thing that you'd like to build on when it comes to partnering rural and urban health care providers?
I think, and this may be counterintuitive, is a recognition of the fundamental importance of the intimacy of healthcare, and that healthcare is about relationship. It's about that local partnership between a clinician and the patient and the family. And everything that drives us, I think, is to support and build on that relationship, which is at the very heart of healthcare. I mean, we can have all the regional systems and all the large computer systems and all the technology, but if we don't get it right at that one-on-one level in the local community when that patient or family is with the doctor or nurse, we all fail, both urban or rural.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
That's Tim Size. He's Executive Director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a personality expert about the differences between introverts and extroverts. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we look at a school district boundary in Wisconsin, which a new report says is among the worst segregating school district borders in the country.
First, ever since the publication of Susan Cain's book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, introversion has been in. People are celebrating the fact that it's okay to stay in, it's okay to need time to recover after lots of social interaction. And yes, it's okay to regulate how much interpersonal stimulation you get.
We talked to some people at WPR about whether they were introverts or extroverts, and here's what they had to say.
Extreme introvert. Any social interaction feels like, you know, using those hand exercise things where you're like just like making a muscle, like anytime just making a muscle for an extended period of time, and then you just like, I'm so exhausted by the end of it, just sort of mentally.
When I discovered the term extrovert, I thought that matched with me well. I thought I could very well identify with that term because that explained my personality.
I'm an introvert. I think it's deeply affected my ability to get out there and make my life happen in a really meaningful way.
I am an extrovert. But I oftentimes get mistaken for an introvert because I actually don't like to talk that much. I like to be around people. Even if I'm not speaking to them, just knowing that they are there makes me feel energized.
Because of my job responsibilities and just experience alone, I am still an introvert, but I am not shy anymore. But I do need time to recharge. So I am out talking to people and being seemingly extroverted. It is exhausting for me, and I do need time to go home and just be by myself. It's hugely important for me to do that, recharge my batteries.
Are you an introvert or an extrovert? How important do you think that is to who you are or to the rest of your personality? How do you deal with people who are on a different part of the introvert-extrovert spectrum than you? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Brian Little says people who see themselves as nothing but introverts are limiting themselves, and he's here with us to explain why. He's the author of Me, Myself, and Us, The Science of Personality and the Art of Well-Being. He's a fellow of the Well-Being Institute and director of the Social Ecology Research Group in the Department of Psychology at Cambridge University. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, why do you think that people who decide that they are introverts are limiting themselves?
Well, it really goes to the whole issue of whether you should label yourself. It's a little bit like putting yourself in a pigeonhole, and I'm not even sure that pigeons belong in pigeonholes. And so I think that the awareness that people began to get in reading Susan Cain's book was really important. They realized that they could be described as introverts, and that didn't mean that they were failures or that they were useless or that they couldn't be expected to rise to occasions. And that was terrific. But now I'm experiencing the phenomenon of introverts perhaps shortchanging themselves and cutting too short the prospects for living well, because they rest in that little rabbit warren that they've created for themselves. And I think that can be constricting.
Are you saying that's in part because of the spotlight that Susan Cain's book Quiet has shined on the value of being an introvert, that people are maybe embracing it too much?
Fewer are perhaps embracing it too much. It's giving them an excuse for not venturing out in their lives. But on a whole, the effect of Susan's book has been terrific. It's been emancipatory for a lot of people who thought themselves abnormal or strange because they didn't engage with the social world in a way that their extroverted friends would. And I think that's been wonderful. I do think, however, if you glom on to the title, I'm an introvert, and that's the only thing that defines you, then I think that can be constraining. One of the folks that was speaking in the preamble was saying that because of her professional role, she has to, in my terms, act out of character. She's introverted, but she has to act in an extroverted fashion for her professional roles. And one of the chapters of Susan Cain's book is precisely about this, chapter 9, and she talks about this strange Canadian professor at Harvard University who hid from his students but entertained them rapturously because he was a pseudo-extrovert. And that guy happened to be me.
Ah.
and I'm like many of your listeners. I'm what I call biogenically introverted. Part of my neurochemistry is such that I get over-aroused with too much stimulation, and social stimulation is a good example of that which can be truly arousing. But and consequently, I need to retreat from too much stimulation in order to carry out my tasks or my projects effectively. And so we act out of character at times. So I'm a professor, and my chief core project in my life is to profess. And that means that we have to act in a somewhat extroverted way when we're lecturing or when we're on public radio. You don't want me to back off and say, I have nothing to say about that.
And you did a TED Talk.
Oh, yeah, I did. I'm trying now not to say anything so that you will see how hard it would be to be an introvert when you're playing into a social role and there are social expectations. Take a mom at a birthday party, and she's introverted. She acts as a pseudo-extrovert because she wants to put on an awesome birthday party for Emma. But at the end of it, she may be truly exhausted and want to retreat to the washroom and just quieten herself, whereas a true extrovert will have another party when the parents come to pick up the kids. And don't we need them all? Don't we need all these different kinds of people? And the other reason I think it's restricting to say, I'm an introvert, damn it, is that that's just one of five major dimensions of personality that we really need to take into account when we're understanding people. The other four are it spells out an acronym, OCEAN, so that openness to experience is one of them, conscientiousness is another, extroversion is the third, agreeableness is the A, and neuroticism is the N of OCEAN. And if you and each of these is independent of the other, meaning that you can be high on one or low, and high or low on each of the others. So the difference between an introvert who's disagreeable and neurotic is very different from an introvert who's agreeable and stable. And so simply to say that you're an introvert is cutting out all those other dimensions of personality, and I haven't even gotten into the subset of those characteristics that make us who we are.
We're talking with Brian Little right now. He's the author of Me, Myself, and Us, The Science of Personality and the Art of Well-Being. And he says it's a lot more complicated than just introvert and extrovert, and that by slapping ourselves with one of those labels, in particular this time introvert, we may be limiting ourselves and narrowing the scope of everything that we are. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got Jennifer on the line with us in Fitchburg. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. Well, I'm actually finding it strangely liberating that I can now say I'm an introvert trapped in an extrovert's body. It's taken me 40 years to realize that that's the case. I have a very extroverted way of living. My careers are all very extroverted. People would think that I'm a lot more, whatever you want to define that as, extrovert. But I recently learned about the perspective that how you recharge has a lot to do with whether you are extroverted or introverted. I know one of your colleagues in the kind of preview mentioned that, too, that I definitely recharge with more solitude, even though I have a very outgoing sort of general lifestyle.
Interesting. What is your profession, Jennifer?
I teach math to middle schoolers, and I'm also a group fitness instructor, so those alone sort of pigeonhole me for people, but I really like my alone time, ironically.
Right. So you're out there. Jennifer, thanks so much for sharing that. And Brian, that is something that a way people define themselves. Do you think that's accurate? If you say, I recharge by being alone, you're more introverted. If you recharge with people, then you're more of an extrovert.
Yeah, I think that is fair. I think the common element is that introverts need to recharge by reducing stimulation, and that can mean being alone or listening to soothing music or anything that is going to reduce the arousal level that you experience in the part of the brain we call the neocortex. For extroverts, recharging can be the exact opposite. They may find after, particularly if they have been acting as a pseudo-introvert because their job demands it, after work, they don't want just to be on their own. They want to get out and go crazy at a club or, depending upon where they are in the life cycle, and get stimulated. There's another aspect, though, of sort of cutting ourselves short and simply saying that we're an introvert, for example, instead of being open to the possibility that there were many different things during our daily lives. And that is some recent research by a fellow called John Zelensky, who's shown that when introverts and extroverts are asked to anticipate how they will feel at an upcoming social event, the introverts predictably say they won't enjoy it. However, if you actually observe them in those events, they enjoy it. And so what might happen is that introverts avoid situations that they would actually enjoy and benefit from simply by regarding their settled views on what they're like as settled instead of negotiable and flexible.
Brian Little stays with us now. We're talking about being an introvert or an extrovert and how if we label ourselves with, for instance, the label introvert, we may be limiting ourselves too. Brian Little is the author of Me, Myself, and Us.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see yourself as an introvert or an extrovert? And either way, how important that is that to who you are? Is there a lot more to you than introvert or extrovert? Is it a self-fulfilling prophecy? Do you, if you're an introvert, avoid that social occasion? Or if you go reluctantly, do you end up enjoying it anyhow? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation and get to your calls in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our discussion now with Brian Little about why he says people who just consider themselves introverts are limiting themselves.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see yourself as an introvert or an extrovert? How does that affect you in your daily life? Is that the most important thing about you, or just one of a whole bunch of different things that you'd want people to know about you? How does being an introvert or an extrovert affect your life? How do you get along with the people on the opposite end of things? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll get to your calls in just a bit, but first let's hear more from one of our WPR staffers.
There's this popular quote that a lot of artists have been using. You hear it in movies, and it's the loudest one in the room is the weakest one in the room. And the more and more I kept coming across that quote, I'm like, well, I don't want to be perceived as weak. So I became more conscious of how soon I would speak, if I would be the first person to speak in the room, and how much I would speak.
So that's an interesting one. I mean, do you think, Brian, that there are prejudices against both introverts and extroverts, and we base our behavior a little bit on the ways that we think we might be perceived in that category?
Very much so. That was a really interesting observation that she made. And she's trying to modulate her behavior to live up to certain social expectations. I find that increasingly extroverts are becoming concerned that they are perceived as overly garrulous or coming on too strong, and they're attempting to modulate their behavior, just as more introverted people are trying to lean in more and be more socially engaged. And I think this captures more of what human personality is like than just the labeling of us as an introvert or an extrovert. We're constantly trying to negotiate our lives and craft our lives in ways that will sometimes embody one aspect of a trait dimension and sometimes another. And one other way in which I think it is limiting only to focus upon those traits is that I think a more central question is, what are the projects in your life that matter to you? And these personal projects, these core projects, are what drive our behavior. They may enjoin us to act out of character. Your most passionate project in your life is caring for your mom, because she's entered a stage of her life where she's beginning to experience some cognitive decline, and you're scared for her, and you're trying to get her into a facility, and there's intransigence and a buildup of resistance administratively, and so you, as a normally agreeable person, become strategically disagreeable for all of August. That, to me, is acting out of character. And it's to advance a core project of get my mom into a care facility that's right for her. And the same with extroversion and introversion. You can switch which end you experience or you enact to advance a core project. You may, however, risk burning out. And you can ameliorate that if you find what I call restorative niches, in which you can become your biogenic self after acting out of character. So, as a highly introverted person acting extrovertedly, you might find that you need to retreat into a restorative niche. Mine is a washroom with my feet up. Hmm. Others may find that they're naturally disagreeable people, and they had to act agreeably, or a conscientious person has been asked to fake acting the opposite.
Let's get a couple of our callers in on this. A lot of people who are wanting to talk to you. This is Cynthia first in Strum. Cynthia, hi.
Hi.
What is your comment?
Well, I've always been introverted. And my whole life, it's been wrong to be introverted. The social norm and acceptable was to be an extrovert, to want to go to parties and want to go to functions and want to be talkative and talk to people. So I've really enjoyed the last 2 years when it's become much more socially acceptable to say, hey, I'm an introvert. I'd rather stay home and watch a movie or stay home and read a book than go out and party with everybody. So to me, it's very freeing to be able to say, hey, no, I'm an introvert. This is what I want to do. This is what I want to do, and it's okay.
Cynthia, thanks a lot for that. And Cynthia's getting at what you were talking about earlier, Brian, that this is a liberating moment for a lot of introverts because they do feel like it's okay to not engage as intensely with the world maybe as other people. But are you worried about someone like Cynthia that she will take it too far and maybe not push herself to go to that party that you say she might enjoy if she goes?
I think it's something we need to be aware of. I think we have all assimilated the message that I think was really launched by Susan Cain's book. I think that point has been made and it has formed what Susan Cain and others are calling a quiet revolution. And revolutions can play themselves out, but there may be some downside to taking it too far. And one of the downsides is if you only think of yourself as an introvert, then your degrees of freedom, the amount of freedom you have to enact your life in a way that is meaningful and rich and so on, can be shortchanged.
Cynthia, thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it. And we're going to go next to Mary in Chicago. Mary, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. I'm actually a clinical psychologist, and when I went back to graduate school in 2000, a couple of years in, we had to do the Myers-Briggs. And I came out all the way to the end of the E of extrovert. And so I call myself a capital E extrovert.
Ah, wow. And so have you experienced any sort of pushback, do you think, lately in the way extroverts are perceived, kind of like we were talking about, or do you fully embrace the extroverted part of you?
Oh, I fully embrace it. I can talk to anyone, anytime. I get along with most people. I've had some very good friends who are, some would say, introverted or shy. I'm comfortable in most situations. I'm quite outgoing in many areas, so I am fine with it. I laugh about being a capital E extrovert. We actually had to take it before we walked in the door the first day of the class, and the instructor said, gee, Mary, I've never seen anybody all the way to the end of a scale like this.
Wow, Mary is a capital E extrovert, and she's happy with it. Now, let's take the flip side of this, Brian. Do you think that she could think about embracing maybe some of the positive qualities that might go around, that she might associate with introverts, the way that we're saying introverts could maybe embrace some of these other personality facets?
She sounds absolutely delightfully happy with her life, and I wouldn't want to step in and say, curtail yourself, woman, or bite your extroversion and hold your tongue. Of course not. Nor would I say that to an introvert who is happy and living a quiet, reflective, thoughtful life. What I do see, though, are particularly with my students, that they will sometimes, because they're not yet fully mature, they give themselves that identity that sticks with them for some time, and I think restricts the freedom they have to explore life, either by going out as an introvert into the crazy world that's out there, or for introverts, they may preclude themselves from turning inward and reflecting more about their life and having those quiet times that can be quite magical because they're so delightfully caught up in the buzz of social stimulation.
Well, Brian, it's been fun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Brian Little, author of Me, Myself, and Us, A Science of Personality and the Art of Well-Being. He's a fellow of the Well-Being Institute and director of the Social Ecology Research Group in the Department of Psychology at Cambridge University. And you can find a link to his TED Talk on personality over on the Central Time Facebook page. He overcame his introversion to join us today, and we're glad that he did. This is Central Time.
If you've been using the internet for a while, you may remember that awful sound of the dial-up modem, a big part of the history of the World Wide Web.
And today marks a special moment in internet history. On this day in 1991, the first website went online for public use.
The website was a creation of Sir Tim Berners-Lee at the Physics Research Center, CERN, in Europe. He had created a page with hyperlinks for internal use at the lab. And on this day, 25 years ago, he made it available to computer users outside the local system. And so, by some definitions, the World Wide Web was born.
We have a link on the Central Time Facebook page to an archive of that very first web page. And now you can see how that original internet started off. So hint, there is no streaming video, there is no music, not even animated GIFs. It's mostly just information about how to use the web.
Yeah, I remember the early days of the internet, and there wasn't really a lot of excitement on there. You could go to university web pages around the world and see what the weather was like there, and I think people were starting to get into arguments, Picard versus Kirk, that sort of thing. It's changed
right.
a bit since then.
I remember looking at a pine tree in Washington State a lot when I first started going online. Very, very static things. That's changed a lot. I guess we're glad it did. That sound was horrible. So
I'm going to install a modem back in our office, actually.
Great. Well, you're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.